You are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice.
Hi, I'm Sherry Bloodworth, and I'm the Operations Support Director here in Georgia with the Department of Community Supervision. I'm excited to be here with fellow colleagues as we discuss or have a conversation about women in criminal justice. We know that women face specific challenges within the criminal justice systems worldwide, and that these challenges can affect their experiences at every stage, from arrest to incarceration to reentry. So today we have an opportunity to hear from the panelists and to discuss the unique needs and circumstances of the justice-involved women and share a few best practices within the great state of Georgia. Before we get started, I'd like to take a few moments for the panelists to introduce themselves. So, Melanie?
Yeah, I'm Melanie Scarborough, and I'm the Assistant Chief with the Max Out Reentry Program and with the Georgia Department of Community Supervision. And I work as a liaison between the Georgia Department of Corrections, the State Board of Pardons and Paroles, and the Georgia Community Supervision. And I currently work at Lee Arendelle, assisting the women there as they reentry back into the community. I help them transition from incarceration to felony probation and parole, and I specialize in those that are maxing out without probation or parole to follow, making sure that they get everything in line so that they're able to have all their needs met before they walk out the door and have a better chance of being successful. And we also work with lifers, and even those that are not currently assigned to me, we kind of assist in making sure that they understand what they need to do when they're released and follow all their instructions with probation and parole so that there's not any hiccups.
Hey, I'm Pamela Wiggins. I'm the Director of Women's Services for the Department of Corrections for Georgia. My job entails overseeing every female facility of corrections within the state of Georgia. We oversee approximately 4,000 women currently. And part of my job is also to ensure that we are addressing the unique needs of our women offenders. I also have the pleasure of providing resources to every warden and superintendent that oversee our women's facility and developing and researching unique programs that address the needs of our female offenders.
My name is Renee Sneed. I am one of two operations managers for the Reentry Services Division for the Georgia Department of Community Supervision. And in my role, I work with community coordinators and other reentry specialists as they are making sure that we have a continuum of care for people who are leaving prison and going out into the community. So I'm working to develop strategies and policies, overseeing staff, just to make sure that reentry is successful.
And my name is April Ross. I'm the Executive Director for the Georgia Commission on Family Violence. We're a government agency that's administratively attached to the Department of Community Supervision. And we're a unique agency because we're one of the only states, Georgia's one of the only states that has a dedicated government agency that's looking into family violence. And so we have a lot of functions in the state. One of our main legislative mandates was to create Georgia's state plan to end family violence. We also look at the statistical numbers for family violence in Georgia, and domestic violence, dating, stalking, violence, all of that stuff, sexual violence as well. And we analyze that information and look at best practices on how to improve Georgia's numbers. We are very much an evidence-based agency, looking at how to translate what our numbers are telling us into how we respond in Georgia. We have a lot of training involved in our agency. We don't work as closely with direct victims who are impacted by family violence, but we work a lot with the agencies and the partners, community agencies, advocacy agencies that do provide the direct services. And we do a lot of partnering, legislative lobbying, and so on and so forth. So we're great and happy to be a part of the Department of Community Supervision because it's a great partner for us right now.
Thank you so much, April, and thank you all for being here today. Yeah. So the Department of Community Supervision has a very unique mission
to protect and serve the citizens of Georgia through effective and efficient community supervision for individuals on felony probation and parole while providing providing opportunities for success. Just a few statistics we have. We have about 38,500 females currently under supervision right now, which is a slight increase from last year. 25% of our new entries over the past year were females. 95% of our females are on probation supervision versus parole. 35% of our female population are between the ages of 30 to 39 years old. 37% of females are being supervised for drug offenses, followed by 34% for property offenses, and 19% for violent offenses. And about 41% have at least one or more dependents. So Pam, can you share a few incarceration statistics with us, please?
Sure. And it's funny that you say that, because the Department of Corrections, we mirror a lot of those statistics. We have about 4,000 offenders currently, and we have one on death row. We have about 67% who are parents, who are moms. We have about 56% who have a high school diploma, GED, or higher education. There's about 55% chance that they have some type of substance abuse history or current issue. There's a 50% chance that she is the victim of trauma. And unfortunately, I was looking at some national statistics, and it was staggering. From 1980 to 2021, the number of incarcerated women has risen to 525%. Wow. I thought it was a error.
That's incredible.
It's not an error. 525%. So in 1980, we had approximately 26,000 women who were incarcerated. And by 1980, we had a staggering 168,000 incarcerated women involved in the justice system
nationally.
That was staggering.
Huge increase.
Yes. And that's why it's so important that we highlight, and I'm so glad that we're on this panel today, because we need to definitely shine a light on what we need to do to provide support and care for the offenders. I'm very passionate about helping women put their pieces back together.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Pam. So I guess this is a good segue into the discussion about challenges. What challenges do we see with justice-involved women? And Pam, with you being from facilities, I'll start with you.
I think the biggest one that I've seen thus far is infrastructure. There's only one prison in the state of Georgia that was specifically built from an architecture standpoint for women. We have about four prisons statewide, and then we have one prison that is coming online soon. But the prisons that we have were built for men, and then we convert them for women. But that means that you have to know the unique needs that women need. Women need privacy. Women need space. Women need places to take care of their hygiene. It's very unique. And I'm extremely proud of the Department of Corrections, because they have given a lot of resources to address those unique needs that women are facing now. And I can't help but daily go back to the staggering number of 525% increase. So I think that all of us play such a major role in making sure that we're developing those policies and those best practices to address those needs. Sometimes I get tunnel vision because I'm so passionate about making sure that whatever those needs are in 2024, that we are addressing those as specific as possible. And that's why I say the agency, GDC, has done remarkable at putting funds for these unique needs that these ladies have, and allowing us to reach out to national consultants to see what's being done in other states and other countries as it applies to the management of our female offenders.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. And speaking of facilities, transitional centers are also run by the Department of Corrections.
They are.
But we have a very unique partnership with Corrections
we
and DCS with the Max Out Reentry Program.
And I love it.
And I love that
program.
We do too.
Yeah.
So with Melanie, with you being a Max Out Reentry Officer working in the transitional centers, what challenges do you see in that scope of reentry?
Having worked at a male facility, a male transitional center, and a female transitional center has kind of given me a different perspective because the needs of the women are so different than the needs of the men.
Right.
And while we do have fathers in the transitional centers, and I'm not minimizing that,
right.
There are just so many women in the transitional centers that have children and that have families. A lot of those women have had their children removed by Department of Family and Children Services,
right.
And they are trying to put their life back together because as they come to the transitional center, obviously that means they're transitioning back into society. So now the reality sets in.
Correct.
That they want to work that case plan, that they want to put their family back together.
Right.
And, I try to do everything I can to help them, try to reach out to their caseworker that they have with the Department of Family and Children Services by, helping them reconnect. A lot of times being in the prison system, before they haven't been able to make that connection back with their case manager and their children are in foster care with their
right.
relatives. And I understand that families get frustrated with them, but sometimes those family members that have custody of those children have cut ties with them. So it's all about encouraging them to stay on the right path to be able to reconnect. And so I do a lot of work with that, make sure that they have mental health needs that they need to assess. And once they come to the transitional center, they can get involved with our community partners that can get them on the right track as far as mental health stuff, which helps them as they go back into society, but also is usually part of that case plan and why the kids were removed, or substance abuse issues and making sure we have, Alcohol Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous that's actually inside the center. And a lot of times those classes are run by actual residents there at the TC, which I think is a great thing. I kind of have a mentoring program with them, but it's just a big challenge for them to try to work that case plan while they're there and have those connections. But we have a program actually at Lee Irondale, which is a work well program, so the girls learn budgeting, they learn life skills, how to grocery shop, all those things that
right.
they're going to need to be able to do with their families. And I think that that's wonderful. They actually get to have a real graduation.
Yep.
And some of them have never graduated from anything. Mm-hmm. And those women need that. They need that encouragement. They need that to just be proud of themselves.
Right.
Like I said, we address educational needs. If they can work on their getting their diploma, and then a lot of them work on going back to taking some college classes. So if they have, a lot of them have lost their driver's license,
yes.
So we go to court yep. with them. I transport the girls to actual court. I reach out to wherever. It might be 10 years that they've been locked up,
mm-hmm.
no driver's license. Some of them have never had a driver's license.
Yep.
So help them study for their driving test.
Exactly.
They come to go get all that stuff. So they just have a lot of, not that the men don't, but that the women just have a lot of individual needs to try to put their family back together. And sometimes it's just that encouragement and getting to know them and for somebody to look at them and say, hey, you can do it. So I really love my job as a moral
but officer. We really love having a moral officer baked into the program of the TC. It just gives that program a lot more credibility that we are trying to have a seamless system.
Absolutely.
From incarceration to reentry, even though we all know reentry starts where?
And
as soon as there are you sent.
Exactly.
And we keep that in mind, but to have a bookend of reentry with a more officer embedded into the program, that's awesome.
I love it. And I like the fact that, those that are a lot of those that I have, actually, I keep them on my caseload if they stay in the area.
Really?
So, yes, I do. Awesome. So as they transition out and they make parole or on probation, then so once they go out, then I remain their officer in the field.
Yes.
So then I go out and make their field visits. So they already know me. They don't feel like, I think sometimes when they have to re-explain their situation, they get re-traumatized and have to tell that story again, how they came to the place that they were. And I think sometimes that's humiliating for them or whatever. They don't have to tell me again. I'm already there. I already know what they're working on. I know what they've accomplished or what else they need to do. And so I like that seamless part that I can, you know, supervise them once they get out. So absolutely. And Pam, we're thrilled about that relationship too. So
Thank you, Melanie. And speaking of substance abuse, we know that mental health and trauma are very big contributing factors to substance abuse and incarceration, particularly with women. When you talk about the 525% increase, we know that a lot of that is contributed to substance abuse, mental health, and trauma issues. So, April, can you talk to us a little bit from your work that the Commission on Family Violence does? I know you guys don't provide direct services, but how your oversight can assist justice-involved women who have been impacted by domestic violence or trauma?
Right, absolutely. Well, first thing, you know, we've already heard about the statistics, and it's no secret that, you know, we expect that on average about 1 in 3 women will have experienced some form of domestic violence or sexual violence in their lifetime. So a lot of times, women who end up in this cycle of, you know, incarceration have trauma that's related to one of those things, from child abuse or from, you know, past intimate relationships where they're in that cycle of violence. We know it's a cycle. And so one of the things that we often are concerned about is when women are arrested, whether it's related to the domestic violence that they've experienced or not, you know, how do you get them out of that cycle of violence once they are back in the community? So, and I'll share this information. You know, like I said, we work a lot with community partners and state agencies. One of the things that came to our attention through some of our research is that women related to family violence, women are actually starting to be arrested at higher rates in family violence incidents. And it's not necessarily the equivalent that women are becoming the aggressor at greater rates. That's not true. Because it doesn't bear on the statistics we see with fatalities and with serious injuries.
Really?
But it is the case. And what it means is that more women who are actually victims are instead becoming labeled as offenders.
Wow.
And when women feel that the justice system is not supporting them, sometimes we know for a fact that they will turn to their own means, which may mean they kill their abuser.
Right.
So a lot of times you see women who have gotten life sentences for killing an abuser or an offender of their domestic violence abuser. And women tend to get much more harsh sentences statistically. I'm just speaking statistically. The harsher sentences for killing an intimate partner. So what we believe in, we work with a lot of partners on the Justice for Incarcerated Survivors, try to get more mitigation to their sentences after incarceration so that, you know, so working with district attorneys, working with courts to see if they might minimize the, or reduce the sentence or adjust the sentence based on evidence that was not admitted that should have been admissible about the history of abuse. And on top of that, I think it's really important from our standpoint in terms of best practices to have a program that works with women who are incarcerated and are going back into the community on healthy relationships.
That's
because what is often seen, well, even if they don't go back to that past abuser,
right,
they tend to be a disciple where
they find one else,
same
kind of person.
Absolutely.
And we see that in corrections so much. And you make such a valid point because women tend to be relational. And so when they get into these relationships, I call it behind the wire relationship, we find so many instances where the victim becomes the abuser because of what she's gone through before getting incarcerated. And making that point, April, about healthy relationships,
That is one of the things that we are really, really focusing on before they go back out into society, to give them those tools to cope with how to disagree.
Yes.
How to have conflict without having physical conflict.
Yes.
That is awesome.
Yeah, and I'll say, one of the things that our agency is also a part of is certifying and monitoring the family violence intervention programs in Georgia. And one of those, we have women's classes and we have men's classes. But yeah, it's really important, and on top of the relationships, to teach how to handle conflict and disagreement in your relationships. It's a normal part of it. But if you've been through a cycle of trauma and abuse,
right,
and that's what you know how to respond to disagreement, then you will find yourself, in a place where you're subject to either being arrested for being an abuser,
right,
or truly becoming a batterer.
You're spot on. Are spot on with that.
Yes. Yep. Yes, that's great work. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, April. To the group, in addition to what April has talked about with those issues and concerns with the legal system, what societal attitudes do you see that differs between men and women who are involved in the legal system?
I read this book one time about the Native American community. I think it's in Oklahoma, where they arrest more women for things like substance abuse, right? And in that book, it talked about the fact that society views us as nurturers and caring and all of these warm, fuzzy things. So when we commit a crime, the same crime that a man has committed, a lot of times in the justice system, we are going to be sentenced harsher.
It's viewed as so much more egregious.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Like, how dare you?
You're the mother of the earth. Yes. And how dare you commit the same crime that a man has committed?
Well, even as being a mother, I think a lot of people think, if they have a substance abuse issue and they're a parent, or they're a mother, well, then why can't you stop using drugs for your kids?
Oh, yeah.
If it's a man, they don't. The children are never brought into that. I don't hear people think that, you're a father. Why can't you quit for your kids? I don't hear people say that. I hear them say, she's got three children. Why doesn't she just get off drugs?
It's the same thing with intimate relationships.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you leave an situation for your children?
Right.
Your mother instincts to kick in and help you get and make you leave. Well, we know leaving is the most dangerous thing. And most of the time, sometimes when someone stays with an abuser, it's not because they want to endanger their children or keep in a relationship that's dangerous. Sometimes they feel that sometimes the enemy you know is better than the enemy you don't.
There you go.
When you're with that person, you kind of know what to expect.
Right.
When you leave, you're watching your shoulder. You're watching on your shoulder every minute, and you're worried about who's coming after you. So leaving isn't quite such an easy solution, but women are often penalized for not leaving.
And what you said about you know that evil that's already there. Well, with trauma and abuse, it's a cycle sometimes. And I've talked to so many women, and they'll say it correlates with he gets a paycheck, he goes out and he drinks, and then he realizes he spent all the money, and now we have financial issues, and then there's the abuse.
Yes.
And it goes in that cycle. So to April's point, they know what they're dealing with, and sometimes they know how to navigate it just enough for their kids. Mm-hmm. That's a great point. A great point.
Yeah, and there's a lot of research out there that talks about some of the gender bias in the court system and in the law enforcement system, because unfortunately, when you think about it, the majority of law enforcement is still a very male-dominated a profession.
Correct.
And so when you talk about officers going out on domestic violence calls, and having to try to, navigate the scene and interview the witnesses and assess who's the predominant aggressor is what we call it now. We used to say primary. But a lot of times they come down to sometimes who hit first or, who's got a scratch. It leads to a woman being arrested who is truly the victim. If you were able to look at the big picture of the history of abuse in that couple. And then
their self-esteem and the shame that comes with that.
Right.
And then people look down upon them like, there again, you have your
butt. So you're the spiral.
It's just round and round.
Yeah. But I would say this, Sherry, that we have an opportunity out of this world in the jobs and the roles that we have to change that narrative.
Absolutely.
I find myself being in spaces a lot of times educating people within our agency that just because she's emotional or just because she wants to know why, that does not indicate insubordination. Absolutely. It does not indicate aggression. So it is very impactful for us in these roles to know that we have a responsibility to change the narrative.
Absolutely.
We have a responsibility to say, okay, let's all pause. In women's prisons now, I mandated that every staff member that works in a women's institution has to take what's called gender responsive and trauma informed training. And that is so important because a lot of times people don't understand the significance of respectful language. When a woman has been exposed to trauma, those things are triggered. If you have a gentleman or another woman working in an institution and using disrespectful language, loud language, all of these things, and research shows it, are triggers. Mm-hmm. And the women who have been exposed to massive amounts of trauma, that takes them back there.
Absolutely.
When you are not being respectful or when you're not respecting boundaries and space. Those are all things that evidence has shown cause them more trauma. So it's really important in our roles, one, to educate people that she's not aggressive. She's emotional, but she's not aggressive.
Right.
And we teach how to de-escalate the situation. Sometimes
that was for that.
It is. Sometimes you have to have a certain demeanor to come into a stressful situation and be willing to explain why you're asking them to do X, Y, and Z. Sometimes with us, we only want to, one, be heard, feel like we have a voice, and then feel like we have that necessary support system. So I am excited about what our agencies are doing to address this, to highlight the needs that we have, and to highlight the pathways in which they have come to my doorstep, because the pathways are different for women than men coming into corrections. So that means that you have to know why they got there and what their needs are and what's wrong with asking them. We can't assume. We need to ask them, what is it that brought you here and what is it that will help you put your pieces back together?
Hey, that goes back with our as Department of Community Supervision,
yeah,
felony probation and parole, our person-centered supervision model, our framework that we have. That's exactly where that goes.
So what is that?
Okay. So it is, instead of just having a cookie cutter thing, we meet people where they are and address their specific needs.
Okay.
With a specific case plan that is tailored just to them.
Okay.
And, that framework also, or that model also includes teaching dignity and respect, mm-hmm, and treating them with dignity and respect in the way you speak to them,
right,
and the way that you talk to them.
Yeah.
And you get a lot better response with that.
I know you do.
And you find out they open up to you so much more.
Oh,
when you can, mm-hmm, talk to them, and when they feel like they're receiving respect.
Right.
And when they feel like they have some dignity. So, and,
I think,
yeah, go ahead. Okay.
We all got a whole lot to say.
We do.
That's a good point, because sometimes I have to tell people we don't cuddle, we don't hold hands. She's not special, but she does have unique needs that are different from the males. So I continuously navigate those waters when I have to explain she's not special, but she is different, and her needs are different. So let's move away from the perception and let's go into the reality of the situation.
I think it's such a key point that you look at what the background is, what brought one into where they are.
because, I mean, even in the domestic violence in, field, we've found studies, and it's so true that women use violence differently. Women commit violence for different reasons than men. And so it's important to understand that and really get into the history of the abuse and the cycle that she's been through. I mean, another key issue is the human trafficked survivors.
Oh, yes.
You know, that end up committing crimes and being incarcerated because of the trafficking and their trafficker, you know, kind of requiring them to do this.
Well, I've encountered several and dealt with several women that are now actually sex offenders and have to register because they themselves were pulled into human trafficking and forced in their position to recruit.
Absolutely.
So now they are labeled as a sex offender and have their own charges. And it's just a sad situation that really needs addressing in those women.
And it needs education because
there you go.
That is it, right there.
You want to call
the education,
but they want to
you know, label them, you know, in isolation. You cannot view the incident in isolation. You need the context. And if our society, you know, we talked about society earlier, if society isn't willing to kind of look at context when it comes to women abusers, women offenders,
right,
you know, then we're going to continue to miss the ball when it comes to how to get these women back reentering in society.
Yeah, because now you have the shame and stigma of being a sex offender,
right,
and then you're labeled with someone that might have committed the crime of child molestation,
which is
totally different than this sort of offense.
And every time you mess up on reentry, every time you mess up on getting that woman acclimated and ready or fully able to be independent and self-sufficient, you open the door to that person entering in, from my perspective, entering back into that cycle of a bad relationship that's going to bring them whole circle back to where they started.
Now, I'm going to tell you something. I realize Georgia's on the cutting edge because we are a hub, because of our airport. We are a hub for human trafficking, too. And I have just started trying to do research. In Georgia, unbeknownst to me, the Grace Commission that is led by Governor Kemp's wife, Marty, she has a Grace Commission that addresses that very thing.
Yes.
Commissioner Oliver is on that committee. So I think that we have a great opportunity to really push how can we serve those who have been victimized by human trafficking. That is so big right now. And it's kind of like a huge elephant, and we got to figure out how to eat that.
It's one of those things that's creeped into my world because I didn't realize, unbeknownst to me, there was a great intersection between domestic violence and human trafficking because they start out believing they're in a relationship with these people and then end up converting them into being trafficked.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Ladies, I think we could probably talk all day long on this a very, very good conversation. I do want to transition now into policies, current policies, practices that we are currently involved in, from the facility side to the community supervision side.
Mm-hmm.
I want to put a plug in for our opportunities in the community for treatment. DCS oversees about 35 day reporting centers in the state. And these day reporting centers, along with accountability courts, there's generally an accountability court of some fashion, if not more than one, in almost every judicial circuit in the state now.
Mm-hmm.
But with the accountability courts and day reporting centers, women can be sentenced to probation to complete these treatment programs instead of having to go behind walls.
Yes.
And this affords these women an opportunity to remain employed if they do have a job, and particularly to stay within that family unit. So they can either still be in their children's lives or go ahead and start working on that family reunification plan if they have a CPS case inside the community without being taken away and incarcerated. So that's just one of the things that we have going on with DCS. Pam, if you will, talk about what you guys have going on in the facility.
We don't have that kind of time, do we? So one of the really, really great things that I take my hat off to the agency, and I have to put a plug in because they put their money where their mouth is. So we have what's called a postpartum unit at Lee Arendelle. This is a unit totally dedicated to helping transition from a woman transitioning from having her baby and unfortunately having to have family to take care of her baby. That is very traumatic for a mom to have to give up her baby because of her circumstance. And we recognize that. And we're not going to further traumatize the situation by just kind of saying, here you go, now you get to go and be a part of corrections. We have a program and a unit that is right next to our infirmary that is totally and solely dedicated to the moms who have had their babies in custody. And it's a 6-week program where they are in their unit alone. They're not with anyone other than the ladies that they have developed relationships with prior to having their babies. And it's centered around community. It's centered around compassion. There is a mental health component because we know that postpartum trauma and postpartum depression is a real thing, and it needs to be given the amount of services that she needs to help get through that. It is a very small wing. They have natural light in there. They have their own hygiene in there. They have TV. They have an emergency phone. It's everything that she needs to feel whole again and to take time out for herself away from the reality of her sentencing to help her get through that. I am extremely proud of that unit that we have.
That's
very nice. That's just one. Now, even if you haven't had a baby, there are programs and policies that we put in place because we understand that regardless of a woman's station in life and her circumstance, no one has the right to tell her what her hygiene needs should look like. No one has a right to do that. So out of
dignity,
it is. Yes. And out of that, we have birthed what's called hygiene cabinets. And these are simply cabinets that we have put in every dorm, in every facility, with every hygiene item that is needed for her to take care of herself, not for her to ask. It is about dignity. It is about preserving that dignity. So those cabinets get filled up regularly, and we don't put limits on it.
That's a huge change from 20 years ago.
It is.
For the first time I was with the MORE program and having to ask for something, you know.
Yes.
And that's embarrassing.
It is. And a lot of times having to ask a man for those items. And what if we're having a bad day that day? You know, so now.
And then he's going to question why he doesn't understand why you might need extra.
Right. So, and why should you have to put yourself through that?
Yes.
That's very traumatic.
Yes.
So out of that, we have hygiene items in there. They get them as often as they need them.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Fantastic.
So, Renee.
Yes.
You guys are doing some awesome work over in the reentry. You are with DCS. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you guys have going on and what connections you all have made through collaborations within the community to help with women's services?
Okay, I'm going to highlight some of the organizations that we are working with. I do want to add a little bit when we're talking about the person-centered supervision, how we take that a step further in reentry services with our community coordinators who are doing some form of case management, which we call strength-based case management, where we teach people who come in to have agency and learn how to solve problems for themselves. And so
that's a big one.
Problem solving.
You've told somebody a lifetime of stuff.
Exactly.
You got ESP skills there.
ESP, motivational interviewing, and all of that. But pulling all that together so that we're not just holding your hand, right? Sometimes people do need extra help.
They do.
Sometimes they need extra guidance. But we always remind them, you have done this in the past. You did that successfully in the past. You are on the road to recovery. You are moving in a good direction. And we honor that, right? And we help them to build up their self-confidence.
Motivation.
And in the middle of the process. And we don't do it alone. We have a lot of phenomenal organizations who partner with us. So I am going to just give us a quick list of some of the organizations who are working specifically with women. They will include domestic violence shelters, pregnancy resource centers. We work with family literacy programs, healthcare clinics. We do a lot around healthcare. We sign people up for healthcare insurance as well. We do work with career readiness programs. One of the organizations in Atlanta is Every Woman Works. They work with women to develop self-sufficiency so that they can one day live alone with their kids and support their families. And they have a holistic approach to the work that they're doing. So they're looking at trauma, right? They're looking at self-esteem as well and making sure that every part of a woman's life is going to be addressed and that they can grow. We work with In Her Shoes in Douglasville. They do emergency housing, transitional housing for up to 2 years. Also holistic, they're doing educational assistance, tutoring, college prep. We have a lot of organizations that are coming along and working with us to move people along to from GED to high school diploma. Also they're able to get college degrees. And that goes toward the stigma and the stereotype, right?
And the economic stability.
Yes, exactly. We've got Four Sara in Conyers, Georgia, emotional, physical, spiritual support. They're working with women who have been a part of the entertainment industry, sex workers, and escorts. So they're doing beautiful work as well. Angels in Flight in Wrightsville, 12-step recovery program for women. Baby Steps Recovery in Douglasville, working with pregnant women who have substance use issues. Motherhood Beyond Bars, we've worked with them for quite a while. They do excellent work with women who are pregnant or who have recently given birth. And they don't only work in the Atlanta or the metro area. They will work anywhere in the state. And they have a doula. And this is a really fancy setup. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Hey, you were saying that about the education and talking about.
Yes.
I'll say one neat thing, even prior to being released, that we have at the transitional center is we have partnered with the community college there. And we have girls that actually get involved in the welding program. And they actually get to go to the campus there and take welding classes and get their certification. And then Kubota, that's actually a global manufacturing company of agriculture equipment, has agreed. And they hire the women there. And I learned something, that women are usually better welders than men because they have little hands and
detail oriented.
Yes, and they love to hire the women from the transitional center, and they made really great money, which allows them to save up and gives them a head start once they are released. And women that are able to go ahead and pay deposits on a place to live prior to their release so they can walk right out the door. We help them go get furniture. I even helped a lady go buy a car 2 days before she was released the other day. And then the day she was released, I took her to go pick it up so that she'd already gotten her insurance and everything. So that gives them a big head start, and I think it is a great motivation and self-esteem thing for them. To see the look on their face, and for them to be able to be given that opportunity with education.
And Renee, you talked about healthcare. You guys are helping these ladies and men, but particularly with ladies with healthcare and dental care. If they can get insurance to get their medical needs met and their especially dental work, that helps increase self-esteem, self-worth, and that will help. It really helps people get better jobs in the community. So that healthcare connection is really important. Thank you so much. And Pam, what's next on the horizon for corrections?
Oh, wow. For women's services, I think I can speak on that. We are continuing to evolve the care around our pregnant offenders. Renee mentioned doula. We have started a doula program at our facility that is totally dedicated to pregnant offenders. There is only one facility that a pregnant offender will go to until she has her baby.
And that same facility has doulas, and they come in. It's with a partnership with Emory School of Nursing. And the doulas are actually nursing, final year nursing students who have passed the background check to be a certified volunteer for the agency. And they come in and they provide that additional care. Simply because you need that support from a non-medical standpoint. You need that support. Some of these ladies, this is the first time they're having a baby, and maybe she doesn't understand a Braxton Hicks and what that is. Yeah. But you have a doula that is connected to you, and we allow the doulas to follow them throughout the process of delivery. They're the ones that are in the actual delivery room with them. It is a great support system. The program is phenomenal. But we can't do what we do in corrections without our leaders. So I would be remiss if I didn't highlight the superstars, the real superstars, the men and women that work in women's services, the correctional officers, the wardens and the superintendents. They are phenomenal people. And they really have pushed our agency out front when it comes to women's services and the care that we provide for the unique needs that they have.
Sounds great. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And going back to person-centered supervision, I just want to talk a few more, because you mentioned the trauma-informed care.
Yes.
And DCS has also mandated trauma-informed care for all officers.
Really?
In the Department of Community Supervision.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
So, you know, I think, yes. I would be remiss to mention or not mention our dedicated officers that work, you know, in the trenches day in and day out, and the support from, you know, their managers and supervisors. Because I think, you know, it's evident that we all are all in this together.
Oh, yeah.
We have three different agencies sitting here. Correct. But we are all intertwined, and we're all working towards the same mission.
Yes.
And I just want to thank you all for participating today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. Goodness.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.